Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Patrick Casey, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. This program is normally hosted by Henrik Palmgren, who is currently relocating across the country. Our guest for this show is Alex Wodosławski. Alex is a political operative who has trained thousands of conservative activists through the Leadership Institute. Now, Alex is dedicated to teaching the skills he learned from his time in the conservative movement to the broader dissident right. Welcome to the show, Alex. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing quite well. Thank you. To start, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so, you know, my name's Alex Wodosławski, and I'm assuming a lot of this is going to be in the intro, but I'll just go over it. So I've been a political operative for some years now. I mean, I'm in my mid-20s, so it's not like super long or anything, right? But really, I've worked in the Beltway and Conservatism, Inc. And before working in the Beltway, I have worked for some campaigns and some like ballot initiative, ballot referendums, and so on. So I have a actually pretty well-rounded background in activism and being a political operative when it comes to everything from elections and campaigns to issue advocacy to youth politics on college campuses. So I think we'll get into that a little more here as we go on, but that would be my short intro.
Awesome. So how did you arrive at dissident right-wing views?
Awesome. Well, you know, I've kind of, when I was in high school, I've always been a little nerdy, I'd say. And when I was in high school, at first I was interested in left-wing politics because this was the time of the Iraq War. And so I was really into the whole anti-war thing. And when Ron Paul ran for president in 2007, 2008, I really started, you know, listening to him because he was the most anti-war candidate, as far as I could tell, who was actually genuine and authentic when it came to his anti-war stances, unlike a lot of the Democrats. And so, you know, I eventually became a libertarian because I started reading a lot, you know, of Mises, Rothbard, etc. I think a lot of people listening to this will be familiar with those authors, those, you know, philosophers, economists, etc., of the Austrian school. And so after that, I decided I wanted to become involved in this type of, you know, like paleo-libertarian, right-wing libertarian politics. And so I think from the get-go, you could kind of describe me as dissident right, though not entirely, but, you know, being aware of those issues when it comes to like foreign policy, monetary policy, and so on, you do become aware of a certain elite, shall we say, a rootless transnational globalist elite. And so I was always kind of aware of those issues, you know, the issues of Zionism when it comes to our foreign policy as well. But I still was libertarian. I was very individualist. Now, fast forward to 2016, you know, Trump was running for president. And especially after Rand Paul's campaign crashed, I could tell there was something extremely wrong in the, I guess, the mainstream libertarian, the Beltway libertarian movement. And I started, you know, I was always anti-Trump. There were a lot of people who were never Trump. And I was like, you know, the guy is populist. He says he's America first on foreign policy. I can take that. I think that's a good start. And eventually, I think just through this kind of strategic viewpoint, you know, I was thinking, well, Trump is going to be good for liberty in the long run because he's attacking a lot of our enemies, right? When it comes to neoconservatives, when it comes to the mainstream media, et cetera. And so when it comes, you know, with the whole strategic viewpoint of Trump was okay, and I was looking at, you know, the alt-right and the broader dissident right and so on, and really starting to read up on that because I was like, you know, these guys are going to be our natural allies. And eventually I kind of became convinced of a lot of the things they were saying, though not all, but, you know, most definitely when it comes to things like, you know, the importance of ethnic homogeneity, social cohesion, the importance of fighting, you know, against open borders, immigration, and so on and so on. And so throughout 2016 and then 2017, I really got on board more with dissident right-wing views.
Interesting. So the main topic of the show is activism, particularly right-wing activism. But before we delve too far into that, can you explain to the audience what activism is and why people should engage in it?
Yeah, so I'd say activism is, the root of the word is being active, right, politically. So how do you do that? And I think a lot of people have the wrong idea of it, right? Activism isn't really posting on Twitter or Facebook, though social media can be helpful to a larger goal. But really, I think when we're talking about activism, we're talking about IRL, you know, in real life, things that you can do, right? When it comes to, you know, anything from door knocking to petitioning to holding, you know, like a march or a protest or anything along those lines, or, you know, trying to put pressure on a given politician to get them to vote a particular way on a particular bill, for example. And so I would say activism in general is just going out there in the real world and trying to do, trying to have an effect on the political realm. And I want to distinguish that from, you know, I think there's other forms of activism that can be helpful, like, let's say, cultural activism, right? Like if you're an artist or if you're someone like you, for example, when you're doing, Red Ice. Red Ice is very important when it comes to, you know, like I would say culture and getting information out there. And that's good and that's necessary. But political activism per se has to be more on the ground. And not everyone can do what, say, Red Ice does, right? Not mm-hmm. everyone can build up a large audience, and that's not the proper niche for everyone. But a lot of people can get involved politically in the grassroots, on the ground, to actually grow the movement slowly. It won't be as large of an effect per individual as, say, you know, Red Ice is, right? But they can do things to grow the movement IRL on the ground, getting off their keyboards, getting off their computers, and actually interacting with real people. So that's how I would define right-wing activism.
So you wrote an article back when you were working in the conservative movement titled How to Grow a Grassroots Group in 5 Easy Steps. Why don't you talk about the article and walk us through those 5 steps?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote this when I was working for a conservative nonprofit where, you know, basically what we were doing was we were helping conservative and libertarian campus organizations, right? So so this article is geared towards that. Now, I think this is actually something that a lot of people more on the dissident right, for example, people perhaps involved with IE could use, right? Which is how you go out into the real world and grow your organization. So the first thing, and this is mainly geared towards recruiting, right? How do you recruit new people? How do you build up a grassroots organization where you can have regular meetings, right, that grow, where you have more people coming in, right? So in this article, how to grow your grassroots group in 5 easy steps, the first step I point out is have a core offer, right? So why do you want to start an organization? What is the purpose? Or, you know, why do you want to start a grassroots group, right? And why should strangers you've never met before join your organization, right? And the reason why it's important to define this is basically so you know when you're interacting with people, what is it that you want to bring up, right? Mm-hmm. And so in terms of core offers, there's different things that different groups can offer, right? So a sense of community, right? So if your group holds meetings, then that could be a good social networking opportunity. And a lot of people want to meet and discuss things with people of like mind. Also, personal benefit, right? So we've seen some groups are good for networking for like career opportunities, right? And also social change. And that's obviously what the main offer of your organization should be, is how are we going to get involved in the fight? What policies are we going to change? And why do we want to change them? And how will we change them, right? So these are all things you want to define. And then the step 2 is, you know, investing in marketing materials and crafting your pitch. So you want some sign-up form, right? Brochures, a sign, etc. It's always best if the sign is homemade as well, so it looks grassrootsy. And remember, more is not always better, right? So if you're, you know, out there, let's say you're in front of your public library or whatever, you know, somewhere where there's a lot of people walking by, or if you're on your college campus recruiting for a group, you want to have a short pitch or a question that you can engage people, something that's topical, something that, you know, could be talk of the town or talk of your college campus or whatever. So if you're on campus, you could, you know, if, let's say you're doing a free speech petition, you could ask like, hey, do you like free speech as people are walking by? That's your pitch, right? Or you could ask, if you're doing an immigration issue, you know, and, hey, are you for closed borders or something along those lines, right? And, or do you like Trump, right? That can be a very easy starting question to get people involved in a conversation with you. And then you can tell them about a shorter elevator style pitch, right? A few sentences about what your group is, what you guys are doing and why they should join, right? And, you know, besides that, you just need a couple materials. You don't need anything fancy. You don't want to bombard anyone with a lot of information or tons of brochures. You want to start a conversation, get their contact info, and then move on. So step three is go to events and places with high foot traffic. So I already kind of touched on that. But, you know, you want to, if you're on a college campus, stand out in front of the wherever, you know, everyone goes for lunch, for example, right? Or in front of one of the main buildings where most of the classes are held. That way, when foot traffic picks up, you can go talk to everyone there. In a normal town, right, if there's like a downtown area or something, you'll know places with high foot traffic. And you can also search out events, right? So like farmers markets, for example, are one thing I've done when I'm trying to interact with a high volume of people, right? I go to a farmer's market and talk to everyone that passes by. And so you can always look at community calendars, and sometimes you can even reserve tables or booths at events, right? And plan ahead of time. Now, step four is what I say, use your C factors in order to hook your prospects. So C factors are S-E-E, so like your eyesight, and that stands for smiling, eye contact, and enthusiasm. So when you're talking to people, you know, just be sure to smile, right? Make eye contact and be enthusiastic, be happy, be someone that attracts other people through your, you know, positivity. And oftentimes, like if you talk yourself into a positive state of being, you know, like, oh, you're out there, you're doing something good for the world, you're doing something good for your people, right? And if you talk yourself into a good state of mind, it'll kind of like radiate out, you know, because your body posture will be fixed, you'll smile more, you'll make more eye contact, you won't seem like a weirdo, which is important. And make sure to engage every single person that walks by, right, with your hook question or whatever that you already came up with, like, for example, do you like Trump? Or are you opposed to illegal immigration? Whatever it is you want to ask. And so just keep asking this to every single person who walks by. And it's kind of like, you know, think about it like the dating market. Let's say it's like not every single girl you ask out on a date is going to say yes, right?
Right.
In fact, if you're like me, probably the vast majority will say no, right? But if but if you keep on asking people, you're going to hook the minority of people that you have to hook, and they'll come in and they'll talk to you once you start that conversation with them. So that's why it's important to talk to as many people as possible and get them engaged and then get them to sign up for your organization. And step five is simply to get your new members involved, right? So if, you know, it's very, very important that once you finish a conversation with someone you just recruited, you give them something to do, right? Now, it shouldn't be something like, oh, when you go home, join our Facebook group or whatever. That's kind of lame. I'm saying, like, give them an event to go to, right? Mm-hmm. So they can go meet other people in your organization, in your group, or, you know, it can be something as simple as, like, a social networking event. which is, you know, more like fun, like going to the bar or whatever, right? Going to a coffee place. Or it can be more like educational. If you have, for example, when I ran a Campaign for Liberty chapter, what we would do is we had this local business owner that owned like it was like a bar slash concert hall, right? And so we booked the concert hall on like a Sunday morning, right? And we would just invite everyone to show up there, and we'd have a few speakers talk about local issues and that type of thing. And because it was a bar, it also doubled up as a social networking thing. But anyway, whenever you get a new person to sign up to want to join your group, give them something to do. Tell them, give them a flyer, or tell them, be like, hey, we're going to have this meeting next week, Thursday at 3 p.m., for example, at such and such location. You should come. And while you're at it, you know, grab their contact info, and a couple days beforehand, make sure to shoot them an email or a text message or whatever, reminding them about the event, right? And asking them if they'll come. And if they say, yeah, they'll be much more likely to come. So those are the five steps. So basically, step one, have a core offer. Step two, invest in materials and craft your pitch. Step three, go to events and places with high foot traffic in order to recruit. Step four, use your C factors to hook your prospect, SEE, which is a smiling eye contact and enthusiasm. And step five, get your new members involved.
Yeah, I think those five steps are constitute a pretty solid recruitment strategy, absolutely. So it reminds me of this book that I read recently titled Dedication and Leadership by Douglas Hyde. Are you familiar with it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's honestly, it's one of like the three books that everyone should read.
Nice. Yeah, I figured, I think it was the last step that you touched on there. It was very reminiscent of what Hyde outlines. And for those unaware, Douglas Hyde spent 20 years in the Communist Party of Great Britain, I believe, and he eventually became disillusioned with communism. So he left, he joined the Roman Catholic Church along with his family, and he quickly realized that the non-communist world was really lacking in the leadership skills that communism had come up with on its own. And so he wrote Dedication and Leadership and did quite a bit of activism and speaking engagements to try to teach the non-communist world what they can, you know, what communism in terms of leadership has to offer. And one of the main things that he outlines, and he outlines it pretty early in the book, is that you need to make demands of people. You need to give them things to do to get them involved. It's not enough to, convert, in his, you know, argument, it's not enough to convert someone to Catholicism. You have to give them tasks. You have to get them involved. And I think that we in the dissident right stand a lot to learn from that. That's something we've been implementing in IE a lot recently, is just kind of recognizing that fact and realizing that, you know, people who drop off quite often they drop off because, you know, maybe there's not a lot going on in their city, or just no one's given them something to do. So, but yeah, overall, I think those five steps are definitely things that activists in the dissident right should do well to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, these five steps are more for like going out there recruiting, getting new people. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I'll throw in here a sixth step. Once you already have someone in your organization, right, in your local group, right? And this is kind of based off of Doug Hyde's book and his teachings, right, is give them a title and get them involved, right? You can have a lot of volunteers doing free work, right, for your organization, for example, setting up meetings. You can have someone be a meeting coordinator, mm-hmm. right? Just say, hey, want to be the meeting coordinator for my Patriots of Appalachia group, right? do you want to be a meeting coordinator? Do you want to be a meeting coordinator for my local IE chapter or whatever? And that person will be in charge of doing that thing, right? And if they fail, you just replace them, find someone else. You can have someone else in charge of recruitment, right? And finding, you know, farmers markets and other like local festivals and stuff like that, where you can set up a table, and they'll also be in charge of going there, making sure they set up a table, a booth, have people show up there to help them recruit and represent your organization and so on. So it's very important to keep on, you know, keeping people involved, especially the people that are very interested in helping, give them something to do, give them a title. It makes them feel more important, makes them feel like they have a responsibility to be involved once you give them that mm-hmm. title. So that's a very important thing to do, and to constantly be giving things, giving people, even if they're not perfect, right? Like, you don't want someone who is nutty, right? Or someone who's undisciplined out there advocating for our sure. ideas because, you know, they'll make a off-color joke or something. But what you do want is, you know, someone who may be a little green, maybe they're not 100% familiar. And this is what Doug Hyde talks about is, you know, get them out there, get them to recruit. And oftentimes they'll be bombarded with questions or criticisms from passersby. And then they'll come back to you and they'll want to know more, right? And this is how you kind of get them to want to become more educated and have a better grasp of the ideas behind your movement. And that's when you can, you know, give them a book to read or send them a YouTube video, or, you know, maybe next meeting you'll discuss whatever issues were brought up. So, but yeah, that book by Doug Hyde, Dedication to Leadership, is very important for anyone who wants to be a grassroots leader.
So would you amend any of these steps or perhaps advocate something different for people involved in, shall we say, more controversial politics than conservatism?
From the article itself, no, not necessarily. Now, I'd say that it's when it comes to, you know, dissident right-wing views, we call it dissident right-wing for a reason, mainly because, like, if you have a cushy white-collar job, you know, at a major corporation or something, maybe it's not becoming of you to be a grassroots leader when it comes to, you know, things like, you know, shutting down immigration and keeping, for example, a white majority America, mm-hmm. right? That's definitely way too edgy if, you know, let's say you're a computer programmer from Microsoft or something. So I'd say that in terms of this type of IRL public activism, this is more something that only people that are, you know, if you have a secure job or if your boss is the type of person that wouldn't care, right? I'd say this more applies to blue collar type people, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you have a union job, like where I'm from in Michigan, like lots of people, you know, work at factories, or, you know, even if you like work at the casino, for example, they're actually all unionized with the UAW, which is kind of funny, but, you know, it's a separate story. But they can't really get fired for their political views. So they're the types of people that can go out there and recruit. And I'd say, you know, we kind of have this... you know, I think we're going to discuss this later, but, you know, Charlottesville, I think, unjustly ruined the idea of IRL activism for the dissident right wing, because I'm not going to name anyone, but, you know, certain movement leaders, not only did they not learn from the mistakes in Charlottesville, which was basically, oh, let's invite everyone right. to show up to this event, right? They kind of doubled down on it in future events. Right.
Yep.
And so that really, you know, that damaged the alt-right brand, essentially. But because of that, everyone's scared to come out there. And while it's not appropriate for everyone to do so, I think there still are large numbers of people that can go out there and publicly advocate for ideas, if they do so in a disciplined manner, in a smart manner. Right. And they can grow grassroots groups and they can do IRL activism as long as they do it right. And as long as they make sure that the people they bring in are, you know, quality people and are going to be disciplined and won't go out there and say dumb things. Now, I want to add one more little sure. side statement here is like, this isn't new to the dissident right. Okay. So for example, if you look at like the Ron Paul Liberty movement, when we were doing grassroots stuff, there were a lot of people who ended up kind of, you know, joining up for a little bit that were like, all they wanted to talk about were 9/11 conspiracy theories, right? And obviously this wasn't going to help Ron Paul. It wasn't going to help the Liberty movement if everyone wants to talk about 9/11 conspiracy theories all the time, because that's not the point of what we were doing then. And so you have to figure out a way to filter out those people. Likewise, you know, you have to figure out to filter out people when it comes to the dissident right, but this is going to be natural in any grassroots movement, right? Every single grassroots movement, by definition, by virtue of being grassroots, you get people from all walks of life with all different types of ideas, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of those people, or a significant proportion of them, in any grassroots movement won't be presentable, right? You can think of the left, like the crazy cat lady feminists and so on, or, you know, the tranny with purple hair. Like, most people aren't going to want to talk to that person. And that shouldn't be the face of your movement. And that's fine. So, you know, remember, the other side has troubles too, and these aren't unique things to us or to our movement.
Yeah, I think anyone involved in the endeavor of trying to change public opinion has to be concerned with optics to a certain extent. I've seen people on the right argue that, you know, Antifa doesn't have to worry about optics, therefore we are stupid to worry about it too. But kind of what you were getting at just now is that, you know, even within the left, they actually do have debates on optics. Some of the DSA types, the more democratic socialists, they don't really like the anarchists. There was a big split in the Occupy Wall Street movement around that issue, right? Some people wanted to not take showers and throw glass bottles at police, right? And other people wanted to, you know, maybe show up looking friendly and talk about socialism. So, as you said, these issues, these debates aren't anything new, and they're not anything exclusive to the right. So I want to switch gears here and talk about another article you wrote, this one for America First Media, titled How to Infiltrate the Mainstream. Why don't you explain some of the key points you outline in that article?
Yeah, well, so the main thing, well, let's start kind of on a more meta level. The way I think about politics, the way I think is the proper way to think about politics, and specifically political activism, of course, is that you don't need to be a majority to have an influence on politics, right? Now, I'd say, now look at some of the targets of, you know, who the dissident right wing complains about. A lot of them aren't the majority. For example, boomers, right? We're always complaining about boomers, okay? Now, I also complain about boomers, but we have to recognize they're not the majority of the population, right? Now, why is it that boomers have a disproportionate effect on American politics, especially on the right wing? It's because they're actually way disproportionately involved. Go to any Republican Party meeting, the majority of the people are going to be boomers, or they're going to be, you know, Gen Xers and some millennials who work for the party or for a state legislator or something along those lines, right? So, and this represents a huge area, I think, where we can get, you know, we can infiltrate the Republican Party, and we can start having an outside voice within that party, right? And when it comes to things like deciding which candidates to fund, which is something your local state Republican Party makes decisions about, you know, we can have an outsized voice. And I'll give another example here is going back to the Ron Paul days, right? When, for example, the Iowa Republican Party, for a period of a couple years until people lost interest, was actually taken over by Ron Paul Republicans. And even though Ron Paul didn't win the primary, he won the majority of the delegates out of Iowa because Ron Paul activists were more engaged with the political party than, say, Santorum and Romney people mm-hmm. were, right? And we saw this in other states as well. You know, I think Louisiana was one, and Maine was another, right? And, you know, they had an outsized voice. Now, of course, they couldn't win the whole thing for Ron Paul, but, you know, they were able to have an outsized voice in other areas as well. And this is something that we need to start engaging in, right? Is start infiltrating the Republican Party, start being more active when it comes to things like grassroots lobbying, confrontational politics, putting pressure on politicians and demanding they do something that we want them to do, you know, vote a certain way on a bill, et cetera, and start putting pressure on all of them, right? And if people on the distant right wing, I mean, if you look at some of the our website, you know, they're equal to or even larger in terms of audience and traffic than Conservative Inc. websites, right? So there's no reason why we can't mobilize a large number of people to put pressure on politicians to get involved politically. So that's kind of my point with my article, How to Infiltrate the Mainstream. It's we need to start doing this, right?
Absolutely.
And I just said that we need to, like, a minority of people can make policy or be significantly influential in the policymaking process, right? And, you know, we see this repeatedly, right? Like I said, boomers are one, you know, a certain transnational elite is another minority that's extremely influential in the policymaking process. And we can be influential in the policymaking process. But there's another argument that people interested in activism have, which is kind of the populism versus the elitism argument, right? And elitism is the idea kind of like Antonio Gramsci or Friedrich Hayek had this idea of top-down social change, right? Gramsci's idea was like the long march through the institutions, which was, you know, essentially we'll take over academia and media, etc. Hayek's idea was similar, where Hayek, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, by the way, Hayek's idea was, well, we need a few economists, a few philosophers and legal theorists, etc., to lay out, you know, Hayek was a libertarian, so he would say, lay out the ideas of liberty, and then their ideas will filter down through the media, and the media will spread it to the mass of the people, and that's how we'll win. And I want to guard people against that. We can't follow this elitist model simply because we are truly anti-establishment, right? And if you look at academia, I mean, it's funded by the government, right? If you look at the mainstream media, you know, I would recommend everyone read Chomsky's book on the mainstream media. But as everyone knows, the mainstream media essentially exists to serve the political establishment, right? So we don't really have an opportunity to take over these institutions. They're funded by the government, by the establishment. They rely on the political establishment. They exist to serve the political establishment. So we can't focus on this type of elitist top-down social change. What we have to do is we have to reach out to the mainstream American culture ourselves directly. We have to bypass academia, we have to bypass the mainstream media, etc., and we have to build our own alternative organizations, institutions that talk to the populace. So I do advocate a populist political method, right, which is like we have to go out there, talk to people in the mainstream, bypass all the existing institutions that exist to serve the establishment, and build our own. And once we start pulling people in, we can build a broader movement and start becoming more important, right? And start taking over the establishment eventually. But, you know, we can't focus on like, oh, we just need more philosophers or more biologists. We're going to talk about HBD, for example. Like, that's not going to work. So
yeah, there's definitely a time and place for doing stuff like that. And we should remember that, you know, creating content is one of the best things we can be doing at this point. It's not enough, but, you know, HBD and talking about the downsides to globalism is very important things for us to be doing. But yeah, I do agree with you. I do agree with you overall that the long march through the institutions, I don't think is something, it's really an option for us at this point, at least not, you know, at this stage in the dissident right. When you look at the success that the Frankfurt School and neoconservatives and other intellectual movements have had, you know, they largely had access to anything they wanted. They might have faced some some obstacles here and there, but if you're, I mean, it has to be hard to be a social scientist and be conservative, right? Not even
you know, particularly dissident, not even be, you know, like a white nationalist or an identitarian or something. Just to be conservative within anthropology or sociology will be enough for your Marxist colleagues to pretty much try to blackball you from everything. And generally, they'll blackball you, you know, in your grad program, if they figure all of that out. So point being there is that, people that want to model our movement based on how the left got into power, there's a lot to learn, sure, but the circumstances are very different.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the content creation, I think that a good way of thinking of it is that it's necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? And not everyone is going to be best at content creation, right? So, for example, I'm not the best at content creation, right? I'm not you, I'm not the rest of Red Eyes, I'm not James Alsup or Nick Fuentes, right? Like, I can't go on camera every day and talk for an hour or two about what's happening in the real world, not as well as other people can, right? Or, you know, I don't have the graphic editing skills or whatever. What I can do is I can teach other people these activism ideas. I can engage in activism myself, which is something I've done in the past with, you know, a success and plan on continuing doing. And so this is what I can do. And this is something a lot of people can do with, you know, very little training and education. You can start building a local organization, especially if you join up with a larger national group, right? So, and you can start doing these things yourself. And this is something that I think more and more people need to start doing if we want to be successful. And so like things that Red Ice, it's necessary. It's not sufficient. So how can you, the person listening, the audience, how can you get involved and help grow the dissident right wing, the nationalist, or the identitarian movement? Well, you need to start getting involved IRL. So
absolutely. And, you know, one of the most important things that we can do is really, it's just to build social capital. That's something that I really harp on quite a bit. But not only is social capital useful for affecting social change, but Americans, particularly white Americans, are really starved of it, right? Putnam's work is something that we talk about quite a bit on Red Ice, and I talk about it individually as well. But since the mid-60s, America's social capital has really been obliterated by a number of factors. It's not all due to immigration and diversity, as some on the right would argue. But yeah, the point being is that we need the dissident right to be a force in society that has institutions, that has clubs, organizations all across the country. And once we really have that infrastructure in place, then we'll really be able to, we really want to win over the support of our target demographic, which is largely Americans of European heritage. And we need them to see us as competent, intelligent, capable people that understand the ills of the world and are actively working to try to address them. I shouldn't say the ills of the world overall, just mostly America and to a lesser extent, Western civilization overall. But on the subject of politics, do you think a nationalist or identitarian takeover of the GOP is a possibility?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely. I don't think necessarily a complete takeover, but if nationalists and identitarians and other people on the dissident right are willing to be disciplined and get involved in real life activism and, you know, sign up to become a precinct delegate or a precinct committeeman in their, you know, state or local Republican Party and go from there and recruit other like-minded people, you know, persuade some people, but mostly it's just going to be a process of recruiting people who already hold our ideas or ideas that are similar to ours, right? And get them involved in the political process. I think just that will become a force that Republicans will have to listen to, right? Now, that's not taking over the Republican Party. That's just becoming essentially part of the constituency where they have to get our votes, right? And if they don't get our votes, they lose. That's essentially the type of situation we have to set up. And if we start taking over the Republican Party, we can seek out allies. I think. So, for example, you know, there's a lot of, I think, social conservatives, Christian conservatives, who they may not fully agree with us, but when we become a viable political force or an important political force, right, they may become an important ally. Maybe, maybe not, right? But if they do, then we can, for example, work together to help elect a nationalist Christian conservative candidate who's going to shut down the border. He'll probably be like 110% pro-life or whatever, right? And et cetera, et cetera. Or maybe in certain other areas, there might be some right-wing libertarians or something we can work with, or some more civic nationalists or whatever we can work with. And it really depends state by state, or even by different municipalities. Cities are going to be different than rural areas, and you know, urban districts when it comes to Congress are going to be different than rural districts, etc. But I think this is something that if we come at this with the right attitude, which is we're going to be disciplined, we're going to recruit new people, we're going to get people who hold our ideas more involved, and we're going to be willing to work with people who aren't in the establishment, who may want something, you know, from the current order. They might want to change it in a way that might be favorable with ours. We might figure out a way to work with other groups and essentially become an important factor within the Republican Party that's able to influence it, right? Now, can we take it over completely? Maybe. Now, before we do that, though, we have to take the baby steps of actually getting involved, right, in the first place. So that's what I would say is, you know, maybe 10 to 20 years from now, maybe 30 years from now, could we take over the Republican Party? Yeah, quite possibly, but it's not going to happen unless we start taking steps now, you know, to actually get to that point at some point in the future. So
yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. So I want to go ahead and take a break here, but before we do, I want to ask you one more question. Given America's current demographic trajectory, will right-wing politics even be an electoral possibility in the upcoming decades?
I think so, yes. And it really depends. You know, if we don't change anything in the next 100 years, then no, it probably won't be a possibility, right? At least not in any way that we would recognize it as right wing. But I think, you know, let's see, America is supposed to become a white minority or plurality. Like, whites won't be the majority anymore. Was it 20 years from now?
2045 is the projection.
Okay. So a little more than 20 years. Well, you know, 20 to 30 years, right? We won't be the majority. The thing is, you know, whites still vote more than other demographics, right? So I think white identity politics in some form is going to be the future of the Republican Party. And we have to, you know, we're the best situated to take the reins of that, especially from someone like Trump that does so implicitly, you know. We're better situated than anyone else to take those reins of white identity politics and ride them into power, I think. And once we're there, even when the majority of Americans won't be white, we'll still be able to be influential in the public policy process. I'll give you just one example. You know, Martin Luther King and the Black Civil Rights Movement. Blacks only made up 10 to 15% of the American population at any given point in America's history, yet they were able to influence politics, right, through organized action, right? Now, why can't white people do the same thing?
Yeah.
You know, obviously our issues will be different, but even as a minority, now we don't ever want to get down to 10 or 15% of America's population, but I think long before we get there, we can still change course and implement policies that will be in our benefit if we act in an organized manner and if we're willing to do the work that's necessary.
One thing I will say before we wrap up here is that I don't think we should look at the civil rights movement as being entirely grassroots. There was a fair amount of elite support. But I think as things continue to get bad here in America, elites will begin, more and more elites will begin to defect against globalism, defect against, pretty much become traitors to their class, which essentially is what Donald Trump has done. Peter Thiel, to some extent, Elon Musk looks like he might be heading that way himself. But absolutely, I think that we shouldn't get too autistic, for lack of a better term, about demographics and think that, you know, the minute whites become a minority in America, it's totally over. No, absolutely not. If we have the capital, if we have the will in the organization, then we can, you know, small groups of people can absolutely affect very drastic changes in society. All right, well, Alex, we should go ahead and wrap up for our break here. Before we do, I want to go ahead and ask you to tell everyone where they can find you on the internet.
Yeah, you know, just go ahead and follow me on Twitter. I believe I'm shadow banned, so you're going to have to punch in the URL, which is twitter.com/AlexWitoslawski. And, you know, you can find the spelling of my name on this podcast or the YouTube video to figure that out. And that's usually where I share articles. I write for a variety of websites, and I'll usually share them on my Twitter once I publish something. And you can also follow my other thoughts there. And in the future, you know, I am planning on starting my own project in the future, and you'll be able to hear about it on Twitter when it's running. So follow me on Twitter at Alex Witoslawski.
Awesome. Yeah, and we'll have your Twitter and the links to the articles that we discussed in the show notes as well. All right, well, hang tight, folks. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back.